Everybody, this is the Wednesday, January 27th, 2021 morning session of the Portland City Council. Good morning, Keelan. Can you please call the roll?
Good morning, Mayor. Rubio.
Here.
Ryan.
Here.
Hardesty.
Keelan, are you unmuted? I don't hear you.
I believe
I am down.
I hear Keelan.
Should I?
Am I the only one who can't hear?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep.
Can you hear me now?
Okay, now I can hear you. I could not hear you. I assume you called the roll here. I'm here.
Oh, wait a minute. I wasn't quite finished. Just a second.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Great. Off to a good start.
Maps.
Here.
Wheeler.
Here.
Great. Thank you.
All right. We really screwed that up. We should do that all over again. We didn't practice that, folks. Before we get into the commentary, Commissioner Mapps, you had a comment you'd like to start us off with today.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mayor. I wanted to just take a moment to acknowledge the fact that this morning, many Portlanders are in mourning. Earlier this week, of course, someone plowed his car into 10 Portlanders, killing one person. Her name was Jean. Jean moved to Portland in 1972. She had 5 grandchildren. She was 77 years old when she died. Her family has requested privacy at this difficult time, but they also wanted us to know that Jean loved her friends and she loved Forest Park. So I wanted to ask all Portlanders to join me in celebrating the life of our neighbor, Jean, by getting out to Forest Park sometime soon for a hike. I would also want to acknowledge the grief and gratitude that many of us are feeling today. For many of us, this tragedy strikes close to home. Jean was murdered not a stone's throw away from where I sit right now. I know people who were injured in this incident, and to them, I want to say, I am so sorry that happened to you. Please let us know how we can help you heal. And I also know neighbors who stepped in to stop this carnage. To them, I want to say, thank you. You are heroes. I also want to acknowledge all the public servants who responded to this incident. This crime scene was complex and massive. Our teams at 911, fire, and the police department did great work here. I want to thank every one of those men and women for their service to our city. And thank you, Mr. Mayor, for this opportunity to share my thoughts. I'm done.
Thank you, Commissioner Mapps. And I'd ask us to share a moment of silence together to reflect not only on this incident, but how we can avoid this in the future, and also to let people know their thoughts are with all of those who have been impacted by this situation. Thank you. And thank you, Commissioner Mapps. Under Portland City Code and state law, the City Council is holding this meeting electronically. All members of the Council are attending remotely by video and teleconference. The city has made several avenues available for the public to listen to the audio broadcast of this meeting. The meeting is available to the public on the city's YouTube channel, eGovPDX, www.portlandoregon.gov/video and channel 30. The public can also provide written testimony to the council by emailing the council clerk at cctestimony@portlandoregon.gov. The council is taking these steps as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the need to limit in-person contact and to promote physical distancing. The pandemic is an emergency that threatens the public health, safety, and welfare, which requires us to meet remotely by electronic communications. Thank you all for your continued patience, flexibility, and understanding as we manage through this difficult situation to do the city's business. We'll now hear from legal counsel on the rules of order and decorum. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. To participate in council meetings, you may sign up in advance with the council clerk's office for communications to briefly speak about any subject. You may also sign up for public testimony on resolutions or the first readings of ordinances. The published council agenda at portlandoregon.gov/auditor contains information about how and when you may sign up for testimony while the council is holding electronic meetings. Your testimony today should address the matter being considered. When testifying, please state your name for the record. Your address is not necessary. Please disclose if you're a lobbyist. If you are representing an organization, please identify it. The presiding officer determines the length of testimony. Individuals generally have 3 minutes to testify unless otherwise stated. When your time is up, the presiding officer will ask you to conclude. Disruptive conduct such as shouting, refusing to conclude your testimony when your time is up, or interrupting others' testimony or council deliberations will not be allowed. If there are disruptions, a warning will be given that further disruption may result in the person being placed on hold or ejected from the remainder of the electronic meeting. Please be aware that all council meetings are recorded. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. First up is item number 44, please, Keelan.
Accept 2021 Joint Terrorism Task Force Report.
Colleagues, item 44 is a report from the Police Bureau regarding the Portland Police Bureau's cooperation with the Joint Terrorism Task Force following the formal withdrawal from the task force in May of 2019. Before we hear from the Bureau, since this is the first time some of you will have heard this report, I want to share a comment about procedure. There are four primary types of items that this council hears: ordinances, resolutions, reports, and proclamations. Our established practice is that we do not take testimony on reports, so we're not taking testimony on this item. This is a practice intentionally set by previous councils to give us a tool to hear informational items. In other words, the council requests specific reports back to council on specific issues. This is the fulfillment of that report to the council. We do not vote to adopt these items. The action we take is to accept them. We take that different approach intentionally so that we have a way to officially record that we've heard these items without casting a yay or a nay vote. There continue, of course, to be passionate, engaged community members on all sides of the larger question of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And I encourage my colleagues to take time outside of this specific reporting forum to meet with those groups and individuals. The council is committed to ensuring PPB has clear guidelines on when it can partner with the Joint Terrorism Task Force and when it cannot. The City Council Resolution 37424 and Portland Police Bureau Directive 750.00 spell out the specific parameters of that engagement and cooperation. We have Assistant Chief Michael Leisure and Sergeant Pete Simpson with us today to explain and describe the parameters of that engagement and to share information from last year based on those specific parameters. I'd ask them to also reflect on changes between last year's report and this year's. I understand that council feedback from last year prompted updates to this year's presentation, which of course is how it should be. And so with that, Chief Leisure and Sergeant Simpson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Chief Lavelle has joined us today and I will defer to him for introductions.
Thanks, Mike. Good morning, everyone. I'm here to just do some introductions for the 2020 Joint Terrorism Task Force report. With me are Assistant Chief Mike Leisure and Sergeant Pete Simpson. I just wanted to say we value our partnership with the FBI. We're living in a turbulent time right now. Violent extremism is on the rise. We want to make sure as an organization, we're doing everything we can to keep Portlanders safe. I am in constant contact with the special agent in charge for the Portland office. We have a new one who I've met and am in contact with as recently as 2 days ago, actually. We brief regularly and I approve the reports that are referred in accordance with our resolution. And I just wanted to take the opportunity to say that This is a time where we all need to be very vigilant, be mindful of our surroundings and what's going on in our country, and make sure that we're all doing everything we can to be part of the solution. So without further ado, I'll introduce Chief Leisure and Sergeant Simpson to talk about the report.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Commissioners, Mr. Mayor, for having us today. I realize that three of you are new to the council and were not part of this process last year and the year prior, but I hope you've had the opportunity to review the report. In summary, the council adopted a resolution in May of 2019 establishing parameters of cooperation between the JTTF and the Portland Police Bureau. This was after a previous resolution to withdraw from the task force. In creating that resolution, it did provide a framework in which we can and should work with the FBI's JTTF. As part of that framework was the development of policy, which was created and essentially mirrors the City Council resolution. Because it is binding City Council policy, the policy of the Police Bureau can't really deviate from that. And it does establish clear guidelines for when and how this work can be done. Every member of the organization has to read and sign that policy anytime it's updated. It is going through an annual review process right now with, again, feedback from the community and from the City Council. In the report to Council that is to be delivered annually by the end of January, there are four core areas to report on. The first is the frequency with which the FBI special agent in charge requested the assignment of PPB CIU officers for an investigation, the number of cases that were referred to the Portland Police Bureau by the FBI, the number of cases that were referred to the FBI by the PPB, and the nature of closed cases referred to the PPB by the FBI, including the demographics of the persons investigated and the dispositions of those cases. Going over the four areas, four statistical areas that need to be reported on. To the first question, the frequency with which the FBI special agent in charge requested the assignment of PPB CIU officers for an investigation in 2020 was a total of six cases. There were three different requests that totaled six cases. All of those remain open with the FBI. Certainly next year, we may be able to look back and report on information learned from those investigations. The number of cases that were referred to the Portland Police Bureau by the FBI in 2020, the FBI JTTF referred four cases to the Portland Police Bureau. In accordance with the resolution, these cases were shared with the Criminal Intelligence Unit for review and investigative action, which is summarized later in this report. The third category, the number of cases that were referred to the FBI by the PPB. In 2020, we referred six cases to the JTTF for their review. The nature of those cases included threats to public officials, threats of targeted violence, and a bomb threat. PPB officers took initial reports and conducted preliminary investigation, and then that information was passed on to the FBI. The demographic information about all of those involved subjects were white males. One of those cases was a bomb threat that resulted in an arrest in Seattle, Washington. And the fourth category is nature of the closed cases referred to the Portland Police Bureau by the FBI, including the demographics of the persons investigated and the dispositions of those cases. And I'll just touch on each of these four cases briefly, as are noted in the report. The first case referred to PPB was a report of a person affiliated with an anarchist extremist group targeting a person affiliated with a racially motivated violent extremist group for potential violence. The person subject of that report was a white male. There was no credible threat information located, and that case was closed as not a criminal offense. The second case was a report of a person expressing racially motivated violent extremist ideology online and expressing a desire to acquire parts for an assault rifle and tactical gear. This subject was identified as a white male. He was interviewed, and it was determined that there was no criminal offense committed. The third case was the report of a person expressing a desire to manufacture tear gas, burn solutions, and smoke bombs. That person was identified as a white male. They were interviewed, and it was determined that there was no criminal offense that had occurred. And the fourth case was a report of information regarding an assault that occurred during a protest downtown. Two white male suspects were identified. This case was closed by our unit, as it was already known by Portland police detectives who were investigating that assault, and arrests were made related to their investigation. There was one case that remained open from the previous year. It was noted on the previous year's report as case 10. That case remains open with another jurisdiction and may appear in the next year's report. One of the areas that is of concern for the community is the oversight process and how many people are able to know what's going on with JTTF cases as they relate to PPB. And the way the policy is written and the way the directive is from council is written, it's very limited in the flow of information, so that it must go through the criminal intelligence unit to the JTTF, and from there back through this funnel, and the chief or deputy chief is the approver of that as far as cases being shared back and forth. So not just anybody can send information, not just anybody can receive information. It's kept very limited for the specific reasons of oversight and training. All officers working these cases, whether they're assigned to a JTTF case at the FBI, or they're working a JTTF case that was sent to Portland, must follow all state laws, all federal applicable laws, all city code, city council resolution, and all bureau policies. To violate any one of those could result in discipline, termination, and certainly a criminal investigation if they were to step outside the bounds of their legal duties. That is a hard stop. There is no scenario in which we could violate policy as part of an ongoing investigation. That just doesn't happen. In conclusion, 2020 was a remarkable year for many reasons. Hopefully we'll all look back and find some of the good reasons, but certainly there were a lot of bad things that occurred and things that we had to deal with. From the COVID-19 pandemic to the racial justice events, civil unrest, political violence, and certainly a lot of the fallout from that. One of the good things that did happen in 2020, probably as a result of COVID-19, was that there was a significant drop in domestic and foreign terror attacks in the United States. Everything from an ISIS-inspired incident to mass shootings at houses of worship or schools, mostly because there were no crowds. And that's an unfortunate side effect or a fortunate side effect of an unfortunate situation. But we do see that with 2021, things could certainly change again. We know that the country and parts of our city and county and state will reopen. We will have crowds again. Political violence has continued through 2020 and into 2021, as we saw at the state capitals and the U.S. Capitol. And looking forward, we don't know what that's going to do in the next year. We haven't seen where that's going to go, but in reading a number of reports and reading media reports, the federal government has put an emphasis on the rise in domestic terrorism and domestic violent extremism. And that is something we are paying close attention to. And we do anticipate that this year probably will not be as quiet as last year because of the pandemic. And really, everybody that does this work takes their oath of office very seriously and their duty to the city very seriously, and our commitment to following the rules and laws and the guidance of council as we do this work. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Colleagues, any questions? Thank you for that report. Commissioner Hardesty has her hand raised.
All right, thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Simpson for providing that information. I do have a couple of questions. Though there has been this drop in mass shooting, there's been a huge uptick in racially motivated violence. And your report doesn't clearly reflect the increase in white supremacist terrorism that has taken place in the city over the last year. I'm wondering where that information is, and is that part of, I continue to wonder whether the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the FBI, Portland Police, who is leading the efforts around these racially motivated white supremacist attacks in the city of Portland?
Well, thank you for your question, Commissioner Hardesty. There are different ways that those reports would get sent and would be investigated. We have bias crimes detectives that work, investigate every hate crime in the city of Portland. And they work with, when appropriate, the FBI, a different division. So the civil rights, I believe it's the civil rights squad, does investigations regarding some of those civil rights, potential civil rights violations and white supremacy. Where they might bleed over into our work is affiliation with a larger group, potentially, or we see the online connections between people that they are involved in different chats or groups that are inspiring each other and essentially radicalizing each other into doing mass violence. So it doesn't always fall into the same category. It may move to a different investigative unit. You know, we do look at every hate crime report that comes in. We do review those, and if appropriate, we may adopt that case or share it with the FBI if it's not already being done by the hate crimes detectives, which is a different unit.
And how is that reported to the public?
You know, I don't have the specifics on that because it's not our division, but I know that I believe the state legislature last year created some reporting requirements that for law enforcement agencies to report to the state, and the state will be putting something out, but I'm not totally sure. Certainly that's something we could get back to you on through the investigations branch.
I appreciate that. And I had a couple of questions come up from some community partners. One question that came from the ACLU is whether or not police officers who are working, who the chief has agreed to work on specific cases, what kind of cultural competency training are they going through prior to that?
Well, all the members of the police bureau are going to get the same training through either the police bureau or the city BHR on implicit bias. We have all the racial profiling training. There's been a number of different things the city has offered that officers are required to take in their ambulance service. So they're all getting that same training. You know, we also get lots of webinars sent our way from different organizations like the ADL, Southern Poverty Law Center, that our folks look at and glean new information on how to look at the big picture when it comes to some of the ideologically motivated violence. And that's, you know, an important thing that we recognize that I think a lot of the major, maybe a lot of people in the community don't necessarily understand the difference is, you know, these hateful ideologies are in many ways running rampant through social media and getting into the, you know, minds of our public. And we don't police ideology, but where we do step into the room is when we see ideology start to be paired with plans for violence or threats of violence. And we have to be very conscious of that and not overstepping. We are not interested in people's political views or religious views unless those are being paired with a plan for violence. And fortunately, we have seen a lot of that in the last year, and we expect to continue to see that pairing of belief structures with a plan for violence.
Thank you. And my last question is, were there any times that the Joint Terrorism Task Force reached out and you decline? And I guess that's a question for Chief Lavelle, because he's the decision maker about whether or not we have support, that the JTTF will get support from Portland Police. So Chief Lavelle, were there any time that you were called by the JTTF over the last year that you declined to have Portland police officers participate?
I don't believe there was, Commissioner. I think there were four times they reached out to us. And I think sometimes these cases are in the very, very early stages. But of the four, I don't recall a declination on my part.
Thank you. I guess I do have one more question. So the report that you presented, each case, we found that there was no criminal activity that took place. What is the follow-up to find to make this process better so that Portland Police are not investigating something that ultimately is not criminal behavior?
Yeah, the fourth case was a crime. It just was already known. So the other three cases turned out not to be, a criminal investigation. And I think it's a good thing we're getting the reports, meaning that there are people in the community that are very in tune with threats and people posting things or concerns about people talking about violence and racially motivated violence and things like that. So we're getting the reporting from the community, and our responsibility is to determine if there's a crime involved. So I don't think it's a bad thing that we determined there was no crime. We did the investigation. It's showing that people are reporting, which is a good thing. Certainly I would love to tell you we're going to find more crimes in the next year, because my hope would be we have less problems. But the work needs to be done, and the preliminary information on any police call sometimes warrants a response. But then once you get into the fact gathering phase, you determine that there isn't a crime involved, and that's sort of the end of it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But I guess I would ask you to actually, maybe the criteria is too broad for them to invite Portland Police Bureau to come in. So maybe that's a conversation we have before next year to determine whether or not the criteria under which the chief is called to ask for assistance is too broad. I would love you to check that out and us to talk about that next year. Thank you.
And yes, thank you, Commissioner. And to be clear, the three cases I was talking about were the ones the FBI sent to us.
Yes.
The six cases we sent to them, and the cases that they asked us for assignment, those are open investigations. So I couldn't offer you an answer on the outcome of those.
Yeah, I understand that. Okay. But it just seems, it's just a question that comes up when you look at what you've done, and then you realize that actually most that they have referred to you were not criminal behavior. So maybe their criteria is different than the criteria that Chief Lavelle is using to send information the other way. Thank you. That's all I have, Mayor.
Thank you, Commissioner Hardesty. Any other questions? And if not, I'll entertain a motion.
So moved.
I'll take a second.
Second.
I'll second it. Commissioner Hardesty moves to accept the report. Mayor seconds it. Please call the roll.
Rubio.
Thank you, Chief and Sergeant Simpson, for the update today. And I also want to start by thanking all the advocates as well, whose advocacy and work resulted in what we have today of the city's withdrawal from the JTTF first back in 2005 and then a couple years ago. It's true that multi-jurisdictional partnerships are complex and also necessary to solving the problems that we face, especially in the light of recent events at the Capitol, both here and in DC. But we must do so in a way that ethically aligns with our values of anti-racism and abolishing xenophobia and racial violence. And now with this new landscape, this is more true than ever. And part of our role on council is to hold ourselves and those partnerships that we enter into on behalf of Portland residents to standards that protect rather than profile. And so as such, I will do, I will continue to do so in this case, watch with high scrutiny, especially when it relates to our community's constitutional rights. So accepting this report as council also means that we accept responsibility to continue to push for a high degree of transparency and accountability on matters that deeply affect our most vulnerable communities, and especially in a year when so much is at stake. So again, thank you for the presentation, and I vote aye.
Ryan.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Mayor. First of all, thank you for setting the stage. It was very helpful for being one of the newer members on the council and just have a better sense of what the process is about. And, you know, onboarding is ongoing when you're new, and just hearing the four different types of items we bring to the council was actually very helpful. Also, thank you, Chief Lavelle and Sergeant Simpson. And Commissioner Hardesty, your questions were extremely helpful. I just want to say I'm really glad to see law enforcement taking threats of white nationalists and white supremacists seriously. These individuals and extremist groups are the greatest threat to our democracy and our peace. The domestic threat brewing in this ideology and foundation of white supremacy demand the attention of law enforcement, no matter how big or small these might be. At the same time, our city's history with the JTTF is a harmful and complicated one. And it's one that communities of color, especially Black, Arab, Muslim, and immigrant communities in general are still healing from. And for that matter, people from the queer community. They've never been the threat. And I can only hope that our city's efforts to limit collaboration with the JTTF have allowed Portlanders to feel safety and a sense of belonging in our city. When I look back at the full history of the FBI's often troubled involvement in local politics, including the illegal infiltration of pro-democracy and anti-war student groups in the 60s and 70s, I cannot help but have a pause as I examine the future of our city's relationship with the JTTF. For me, this issue is larger than today's report. Moving forward, I plan to work with my colleagues and take a serious look at how we can amend the nature of our relationship with the JTTF. I would hope that regardless of what this relationship looks like, the federal government would not hesitate to provide local law enforcement with critical intelligence in times of emergency. I look forward to continuing to learn from the community members on this topic, and I really appreciate those who've reached out to our office. It's been very helpful. And collaborating with my colleagues on this important issue going forward. I vote aye.
Hardesty?
Aye.
Maps?
Aye.
Wheeler?
Aye. The report's accepted. Thank you all for the presentation. Thank you all for your questions. Next item, Keelan, please, is item number 45.
2020 Steve Lowenstein Trust Award.
Colleagues, I'm pleased to bring forth the 2020 Steve Lowenstein Trust Award presentation. Each year, the council celebrates the awardee who has made an extraordinary personal effort and sacrifice to improve the quality of life for people in our Portland community. This year, we honor local musician Jeremy Wilson, who had dedicated years to supporting other musicians with the Jeremy Wilson Foundation. I'm pleased to invite Joe Hertzberg and Margie Harris, Steve Lowenstein trustees. They'll speak about the Steve Lowenstein Trust, and they'll introduce this year's awardee, Jeremy. Joe and Margie, go ahead and take it away, and welcome and thank you for being here today.
Hi, well, I'm delighted to be here today. I'm Joe Hertzberg, and it's great to see you all. I'm gonna take just 2 minutes to talk about Steve Lowenstein, because I don't know whether any of you knew him personally. He had an amazing impact for someone who died so young. Steve worked in the earliest days of the Peace Corps and with the Ford Foundation in Ethiopia and Chile. He founded the Oregon Law Center and the Oregon Law Foundation, and he wrote the definitive history of Jews in Oregon. I'm gonna show you a picture of Steve. While I say in Portland City Hall, he was Mike Lindbergh's chief of staff for 6 years. He was trusted as a straight shooter, a consensus builder, and a passionate advocate for the disadvantaged. All these years after his death, Steve's influence is still felt. Every one of you has people in key leadership positions in your bureaus who consider Steve Lowenstein a mentor and a role model. When Steve died, he endowed a trust fund to annually recognize, in his words, that person who demonstrated the greatest contribution to assisting the poor and underprivileged in the city of Portland. For this year, we present the Steve Lowenstein Award at a meeting of this council for the 29th time. Jeremy Wilson joins a distinguished group of local heroes, mostly unsung. It's been an honor and a privilege to give them just a bit of the recognition that they deserve. You certainly will recognize some of these names, but you might not have at the time that they received the award. Selecting the honoree is genuinely the most humbling and rewarding thing that I do all year, along with my fellow trustees. And again, you'll recognize some of these names: Art Alexander, Jamal Folsom, Monica Garacki, Michelle Harper, Margie Harris, Mark Jolin, Paul Kelly, Zeke Smith, and Charlie Williamson. Margie Harris, one of our board members and a City Hall colleague of Steve's, will now introduce Jeremy Wilson.
Thank you, Joe, and good morning, Mayor Wheeler and all commissioners. My name is Margie Harris, and I am a member of the Lowenstein Trust Board of Directors. It is my pleasure to introduce you to our 2020 award winner, Jeremy Wilson. I'll give you a bit of his story. At 5 years old, Jeremy already loved to dance. He formed his first band at age 14, and for 15 years thereafter, Jeremy lived life on the road, touring with his bands, the Dharma Bums and Pilot. It all seemed pitch perfect until one night in 2007 when he collapsed. Jeremy asked the ambulance driver to stop because he couldn't afford an ambulance ride. The driver knew that Jeremy had a life-threatening congenital heart condition, and they went straight to the hospital. In an instant, Jeremy fell into a previously unknown world of people with critical medical needs and no health insurance or savings to fall back upon. 4 heart surgeries and thousands of dollars in medical bills later, Jeremy's healthy. His family, his friends, and his fans had surrounded him and helped raise money for him. His heart was fixed. And in my view, his heart got a lot bigger. Jeremy had learned to navigate the healthcare system and understood how few resources are available to assist musicians like him, and he decided to pay it forward. 10 years ago, he started the Jeremy Wilson Foundation for musicians, their families, and those providing services to them who face a healthcare or other medical crisis. To date, hundreds have benefited from the Musician Health and Services Program provided through the foundation. Jeremy and other volunteers actually answer the phone and listen to those whose circumstances are very dire. They screen and match them with available social services, they raise funds and provide grants, and they make direct payments to medical and other service providers. When COVID-19 closed music venues, musicians lost their livelihoods overnight, and hundreds of them called the foundation for help. By raising over $50,000, the foundation provided immediate relief to over 100 people who would otherwise not have been able to pay their rent, pay their utilities, or buy food. The Lowenstein Trust is honoring the Jeremy Wilson Foundation for the very tangible difference they make to Portland's music community. Thank you for your leadership and your action, Jeremy. I am pleased to turn this over to you to make your remarks with the council.
Hello, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. My name is Jeremy Wilson. I'm the founder and director of the Jeremy Wilson Foundation Musician Health and Services Program. Thank you so much for that kind introduction, Margie and Joe. I'm truly humbled. And thanks to the directors of the Lowenstein Trust for recognizing the work of the Jeremy Wilson Foundation. It's an unbelievable honor to be recognized in the company of fantastic local organizations like PEAR, the Oregon Food Bank, Street Roots, Sisters of the Road, and the many others honored by the Trust. The Lowenstein Trust Award will help so much to expand our support for musicians, their families, and the workers who support them in our wonderful Portland community. And to the Portland City Council, thank you for inviting me to speak to you today. I can only imagine that every level of government right now is facing a combination of overwhelming needs and scarce resources. I thank you all for taking on such a hard job this year, truly. During these intense and challenging times, I would guess that many of you find solace in listening to your favorite music. You may also find that a few measures of a melody will transport you back to your first sleepover, your first date, or your first cross-country adventure. That's why at the Foundation, we like to say we support those who make the soundtracks of our lives. Even in the best of times, people who dedicate their lives to music choose to forego steady incomes and good benefits to pursue their passion and bring joy to their listeners and their communities. Most musicians are generous with their time and live to share their talents. Think of all the musicians you know who have performed for free for your favorite charity or at the bedside of someone who was ill or struggling. And yet, most musicians, no matter how talented, no matter if they perform with the symphony or play blues in clubs, barely get by. And that's in the best of years. And clearly, 2020 was not the best of years. Typically, by March of each year, musicians have their schedules planned through October, performing in city parks and farmers markets, playing major events like the Blues Festival, entertaining at weddings, teaching at music camps, and playing in local clubs. But not last March, when musicians and the many other workers who support live music saw virtually every one of their gigs canceled for the indefinite future. And when that happened, there was no safety net in sight for many musicians, no paid time off, no unemployment benefits for these independent contractors, just a total loss of income. But here in Portland, when the music ground to a halt, our foundation went into overdrive. For the 10 previous years, we had focused on helping musicians struggling with medical issues, from temporary problems like arm surgery to a devastating long-term illness like ALS. We helped them and their families buy groceries and pay the rent, provided professional guidance to assess their assistance programs, and checked in to see what else they needed. Because if a musician isn't working, chances are the bills are not getting paid. Musician Bree Gregg put it this way: as a musician who understands the reality of the industry and has seen so many people I admire affected, I am so grateful for the support you give to musicians dealing with health issues. This career really only works financially when everything goes exactly right, and even then it's tough. But when health issues arise, there just isn't any cushion to deal with it. Thank you. And that thank you was said with 7 exclamation points. Last March, when all the gigs disappeared overnight, we realized that the JWF was the one organization in town best situated to assist independent musicians, and we understood how perilous their situation was. So we expanded our focus to provide COVID relief, and the community responded immediately. By the end of last spring, we had raised more than $50,000 and were able to give grants to 106 musicians and music industry workers across every genre of music and every level of the industry. No one with demonstrated need was turned away. Our support was the first assistance many of these workers received, and for some, it was the only help they got because their unemployment benefits never came through. Our work continues to this day. We've helped at least 136 individuals and their families in the last 10 months and have distributed additional $20,000 in grants since August, and our social services team has been busy helping others find additional resources. We've been supported by well over 1,000 donors throughout the community in the last 9 months, and we still receive requests for help on nearly a daily basis. Portland's music community has been its lifeblood for decades. The city's planning and sustainability focus may have put it on the map for livability, but Portland's reputation is strengthened by its thriving artistic community. Musicians have often been its most visible and celebrated representatives. From the Kingsmen to the Decemberists to Pink Martini, from Paul DeLay to Mel Brown and Lisa Mann, and from Elliot Smith, Obo Adi, and Janice Scroggins to the Shins and Esperanza Spalding, our relatively small community has for years lit up the national music scene with its brilliance. And yet, for all they bring to the city and the state, there's no support system for these artists when they hit obstacles, nor for the independent people and small businesses that keep the music going. Portlanders are generous when it comes to supporting the arts, but when you look at major donations and significant foundation grants, they almost exclusively go to established, well-resourced organizations and marquee events. This support infrastructure does little to help these talented independent community members. I speak to you today knowing that so many in our community are struggling and funding is in short supply. I appreciate this is not the time for grand ideas and big investments in the arts. But as the pandemic eases, as businesses open back up and we are once again at ease on the streets of the city we love, I'd ask you to think about this population that has helped to shape the vibrant, creative, and fun reputation that Portland has earned over the past several decades. Also, please know that the Jeremy Wilson Foundation is here to support the work of the city as a willing and enthusiastic partner. We all love Portland and share the simple desire to keep it a thriving and creative community where all the residents can live full and healthy lives. Thank you again for taking some time today to think about Portland's musicians, truly, their well-being and the contributions they make to our great city. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions you may have, and thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
Jeremy, thank you. And you're the perfect recipient this year. You talked about so many themes that are just critically important, not only during the COVID crisis, but on an ongoing basis, and your commitment to the music community and to the families of our musicians is critically important, particularly at a time of COVID. And you raised the really important issue of the infrastructure and support for independent musicians and artists. And that's something that can go under the radar during times like these. And you've really elevated it. And I appreciate you. This is an award for you. This is your time to shine and our time to thank you and support you. And you immediately turned it around and said, you want to partner with us and help us. And so I just want to say that's A, gracious, B, desperately needed, and C, we accept and we look forward to any ways that we can work together and collaborate together. So thank you and congratulations. And Joe and Margie, thank you for being here again to present the Steve Lowenstein Award. Thank you to the entire group for finding such a great individual to receive this award. In a time like this, to remember somebody like Steve Lowenstein and remember that in his darkest hours, the community was front and center and the people around him were front and center in what he was thinking about as he was achieving that clarity that comes with closure. This is a good time to also remember our colleague, Nick Fish, who loved this presentation. He really looked forward to this and he always had lots to say about the intersection between the work we do here on the City Council and the work that you, Jeremy, and others do in the community to make this just an incredible city and a place we all love to live in. So thank you. Colleagues, we don't take a vote on these items. This is a presentation and an opportunity to really acknowledge Jeremy's good work and the work of the Steve Lowenstein Foundation. that I would certainly entertain any questions. And I think I have them in order here, Commissioner Mapps, Commissioner Hardesty, Commissioner Rubio, then Commissioner Ryan, I believe. So Commissioner Mapps, if you start us off, please. And again, Jeremy, congratulations and thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Congratulations, Jeremy. I want to thank the whole panel for this important presentation. I also want to thank you for all the work that you do. You help keep Portland or make Portland what Portland is. And we're all here because we love Portland. And I just have a very straightforward question. If a Portlander wanted to contribute to the trust, how would we go about doing that?
Well, the foundation, to the Lowenstein Trust or to the Jeremy Wilson Foundation?
Either one, both.
Well, we both have websites, and I know that the Jeremy Wilson one is thejwf.org, and we have a lot of information and a beautiful photo representation of many of the artists that we've helped this year.
Awesome.
That I'd love you to see.
Thank you for that question. It's lowensteintrust.org. We didn't mention that the award comes with a cash component. And, you know, we're really, especially this year, delighted to make that contribution to the Jeremy Wilson Foundation. And the website has got information about past recipients, about Steve, and about the trust, lowensteintrust.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Joe and Margie, for presenting the fabulous Jeremy Wilson to us today. Jeremy, I just want to say I went down a trip down memory lane with some of the musicians you mentioned. And one who was formerly married to a bass player in the city of Portland, I can tell you that music and live music performances is the thing that I miss most during this pandemic. I also want to whet your appetite because, as you know, we won't be in a pandemic forever. And Commissioner Rubio and I are already plotting for a big musical event when we're able to do so. And I will be reaching out to you because music is the soul of our city. And we got what kind of music you listen to, it's the thing that brings us together, right?
Yeah.
From different cultures. And I am really looking forward to us relaunching, being open. And we're looking forward to doing something big. And I know I've talked to Pink Martini. I've talked to several, Norman Sylvester. I've talked to some big names who are very excited about working with us to do whatever this event will be. So Commissioner Rubio and I will be reaching out to as we start planning this process. And of course, everything depends on when we all get the vaccine. And so I'm actually thinking probably in the fall of this year would be a fabulous time for us to have a celebration. But everything depends on how we can do it healthy. And I want to say that you are indeed the right recipient at the right time for this award because of the incredible, I know after being married to a musician, what happens if musicians don't work. And so I just want you to know that I can't think of a better recipient this year. And we look forward to working with you throughout the year to plan for this big celebration that Portland's back. And all our musicians and artists will be able to participate. So good job. Keep up the good work. And take my call when I call.
Oh, I will.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Rubio.
Great. Thank you. First, I want to say thank you to Joe and Margie for presenting this award. A number of my friends and colleagues have been past recipients. And these are all people I deeply admire. And I appreciate this award's lifting up of our community treasures in Portland. And thank you, Jeremy, for your service to our community. I am so impressed with your contributions and your selfless commitment to helping families in their hardest moments, because these are the ones that matter in life. And musicians and artists have been especially hard hit during the pandemic. So I'm especially appreciative of the impact of your work during this time. And I'd also love to connect with you about how I can personally support your mission in this time, if you're open to it. My dad and my uncles were musicians, and I understand some of the hard life trade-offs that musicians have to make sometimes to still be able to do what fills their heart and soul. And our vibrant arts scene is a big part of what makes Portland such a special place for all of us. And you're playing a vital role to ensuring musicians and artists receive the support and the appreciation that they so much deserve, because the truth is that we need them more than ever. So thanks so much for your vision and for your excellent leadership and your big heart.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Ryan.
Thank you, Mayor. I actually knew nothing about this award until I read about it when we got the council agenda. And I am so humbled and just really taking in all the stories. Like Commissioner Hardesty, I was definitely going through memory lane. And even in my own life, I had a health condition that pivoted me from being an actor and dancer to getting a job with benefits. And so we all have stories. And as I always tell my friends in the business world, if you will, like, where's your arts person on your management team? You've got to have an arts person on your management team. We think out of the box, and creativity is what's needed to innovate and to move forward. So I always like to say that, because I think the arts community that includes musicians and the film industry are such an integral part of the fabric of definitely Portland's economy. So when we last week talked about our top three priorities, when we'd hear the economy, I always thought of art, music, and film as a part of that. Anyway, I really appreciate the stories. I love what you've done with your adversity. And I have to say, Dharma bums, right? That was, yeah. So I was young once, and being at, I don't know what clubs now, but they were there, and I was there. And yeah, we all were that age once. So anyway, it's great to put a face in real time, fast forwarding a couple decades. And I just really appreciate what you're doing for our community. So it's really just a comment that even though I'm not the arts commissioner that was selected, nor the self-proclaimed music commissioner, I am a big arts person, and I will be there to help with this big concert when we can all come together again. Anyway, congratulations, great work on who we awarded. And I'll just end with this. I think the infrastructure that we provide our music, film, and arts community has been tested, the lack of that safety net. And so we need to really learn from what you were saying earlier and how to build that into the system with more mindfulness as we go forward. So I appreciate you highlighting that in your presentation. You once again went well beyond yourself, and you made it about the bigger community. Yeah. It's something that I'm sure wasn't lost on the committee when they selected you. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues. Congratulations. Again, Jeremy, thank you. And of course, thanks to Joe and Margie for your presentations as well. This is a great way to start off our day. Thank you.
Thank you all. We're here for you, and let's make those concerts and those events happen. And
we all look forward to it like you can't believe. You can't believe. Thanks again. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And next up, we have the consent agenda. Has any item been pulled off the consent agenda, Keelan?
No, we've had no requests.
Very good. Please call the roll on the consent agenda.
Rubio.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Maps.
Aye.
Mueller.
Aye. The consent agenda is adopted. To the regular agenda, please. Next item is item number 55.
Proclaim January 31, 2021 to be Health for Humanity Yogathon Day.
Colleagues, I'm excited to honor the practice of yoga. Yoga is for everyone. It doesn't require special tools or instruments, and it can be done at any level of physical ability. yoga represents a low barrier option for stress relief and exercise. Representing one of the six major schools of Hindu philosophy, yoga offers an avenue for meditation and spiritual well-being. In tandem with celebrating the ancient practice of yoga, we're also celebrating the work of Hindu Swayamsevak Sangh, or HSS, which has worked to promote the benefits of yoga while offering community services to countless Oregonians. I appreciate the work of HSS, and I'm excited to sponsor this proclamation for Health for Humanity Yogathon Day. And so with that, I will read the proclamation. Whereas yoga is an ancient Hindu practice developed thousands of years ago in the Indian subcontinent for maintaining spiritual, mental, and physical well-being. Whereas Surya Namaskara, or sun salutation, is a traditional yogic practice combining a sequence of postures with breathing exercises. Whereas Hindu Swayamsevak Sangh, or HSS, is a nonprofit charitable organization with over 235 branches in 173 cities and in 32 states, including three branches in the state of Oregon, through which it conducts a Hindu values education program and community service activities such as food drives, providing hot meals to shelters, and providing personal protective equipment to first responders in several cities across Oregon. Whereas HSS is organizing its annual Health for Humanity Yogathon with a goal of having 1,000 individual participants cumulatively complete 11,000 repetitions of Surya Namaskara to promote the spiritual, mental, and physical well-being of all members of the community. And whereas yoga enthusiasts, yoga studios, local schools, and other community organizations are participating in the HSS Health for Humanity Yogathon, now therefore I, Ted Wheeler, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim and recognize HSS for organizing its annual Health for Humanity Yogathon to promote the spiritual, mental, and physical well-being of all members of the community, and hereby proclaim January 31st, 2021 to be Health for Humanity Yogathon Day in Portland, and encourage all residents to observe this day. And colleagues, I don't know if anybody would like to add anything to that, but there's certainly this opportunity if you would choose to do so. Thank you for joining me in this important community proclamation. Next up is item number 56.
Authorize short-term subordinate urban renewal and redevelopment bonds on behalf of Prosper Portland to finance projects in urban renewal areas.
Colleagues, this is a second reading. We've already had our presentation. We've had opportunities for public input. Is there any further discussion on this item? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Rubio.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Maps.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Item 57, also a second reading, please.
Amend building demolition code to require major residential alteration projects to comply with the same site control regulations as residential demolitions consistent with related administrative rule.
Please call the roll.
Rubio.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Maps.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is approved. 58, second reading.
Approve application under the multiple unit limited tax exemption program under the inclusionary housing program for SHIFT located at 5680 North Montana Avenue.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, please call the roll.
Rubio.
Aye.
Ryan.
Aye.
Hardesty.
Aye.
Maps.
Aye.
Wheeler.
Aye. The ordinance is adopted. Item number 59.
authorize a competitive solicitation and contract with the lowest responsible bidder and provide payment for construction of the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant Outfall Diffuser Improvements Project number E06923 for an estimated amount of $5,500,000.
Commissioner Mapps.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor and colleagues. I'm delighted to have the opportunity to bring this important project before you for your consideration. Environmental Services operates the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant, which processes 28 billion gallons of wastewater every year. Once the treatment process is complete, the clean water is discharged to the Columbia River via outfalls near Hayden Island. One of our problems today is that several of the ports in these pipes have become blocked with sediment. This project would make repairs to ensure that the outfall pipes properly function at full capacity. And to tell us more about this important repair project, we have a brief presentation from Philip McCormick, who is a project manager, and Paul Suto, who's an engineering manager, both with the Bureau of Environmental Services. Philip, Paul, please tell us about this.
Paul, did you want to start?
Sure. Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. Thank you for the introduction, Commissioner Mapps. As Commissioner Mapps said, this is a very critical project for us to restore the outfall capacity. One of the things I wanted to note was that it's actually a condition in our permit with the Department of Environmental to restore the capacity in a timely manner. So we've got to kind of schedule constraints to get this done. So I'll turn it over to Phil McCormick now to provide the project presentation. Thank you.
Kaylin, I think you were going to drive slides for me. All right. So good morning, Mayor Wheeler and members of council. My name is Philip McCormick. Again, I work with the Bureau of Environmental Services in the project management office, and I'm the project manager for the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant Outfall Diffuser Improvements Project. So we're here today to request council approval of an ordinance to authorize a competitive solicitation and a contract for this project. Next slide. So here's the location map for the project. The area highlighted in green shows the location of the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant in North Portland, and that's off Columbia Boulevard. The two areas highlighted in red represent the project location off the north side of Hayden Island in the Columbia River. After wastewater at the plant is treated, the effluent travels through large pipes to the two main outfalls where it is discharged in the Columbia River and back into the environment. The plant has the capacity to discharge up to 450 million gallons of treated effluent per day through these two outfalls. Outfall one is located on the downstream side of the Burlington Northern Railroad Bridge, and outfall three is on the north or the upstream side. For perspective, the distance between the treatment plant and the outfalls is approximately 2 miles. Next slide. So here's an aerial photo of the site looking north and west along the Columbia River. You can see Hayden Island on the left side and a railroad bridge that crosses the river. Outfalls one and two are circled in yellow and they're separated by about 1,000 feet. The colorful blue-green part of the image is an overlay of a bathymetric survey that was completed in 2018. The bathymetric survey allows us to measure the depth of the water as well as map the underwater features of the water body. Here you can see the river bed form sand waves in and around the outfalls with lighter colors representing shallower depths of water. Next slide. Outfall one was originally constructed in 1996. The top part of this figure shows a profile or side view of the outfall pipe, which is buried below the riverbed. I highlighted the pipe in pink for clarity. The pipe is about 350 foot long and has 36 riser pipes that extend up through the riverbed. Each riser has its own diffuser port, and I've highlighted the existing diffuser ports in green. The image on the lower half of the slide is from the same bathymetric survey that was shown in the previous slide, but looking directly over the outfall. If you look closely, you can see the dimples in the sand with the Cusar port locations, which indicate flow from the ports. This survey, combined with inspections by diver teams, has also revealed that the riverbed has shifted since the outfall was constructed and sediment has accumulated around the diffuser ports. The line I highlighted in orange in the top figure represents the riverbed elevation from this bathymetric survey. And as you can see, several existing ports are buried below the riverbed. The riverbed is constantly shifting, but the trend has shown a gradual buildup of sediment over time around the outfall. The result is a risk of reduced capacity of flow through the outfall and an increased risk of sediment buildup within the 84-inch outfall pipe. These deficiencies are hindering the ability of the plant's outfall pipes to properly function at full capacity. This project proposes to excavate the sediment over the outfall and install longer riser pipes with new diffuser ports. The new diffuser ports are shown colored in black in the figure on the top. Next slide. So here's what outfall three looks like. This outfall was constructed in 1999. It's 225 feet long and it's 18 diffuser ports. Again, the top figure shows a profile view of the 84-inch outfall pipe, and the lower image is from the same March 2018 bathymetric survey. As you can see, six of the 18 diffuser ports are buried, and there is no indication in the bathymetric survey that these ports are discharging, the area I circled on the bathymetric survey there. Next slide. Here are three photos taken by divers during one of the outfall inspections. In the center photo, you can see that the diffuser port is open and discharging effluent. It is nearly buried with apparent sand flowing into the crease of the diffuser port. So the primary objective for this project is to restore full discharge capacity through the outfalls. This will be accomplished by raising the diffuser ports and replacing them with ports that meet specific hydraulic performance requirements. These modifications will reduce the probability that ports are buried, allow the outfalls to operate at full discharge capacity, and improve dilution performance, ensuring that the city is able to meet regulatory requirements for water quality standards into the future. Next slide. Total cost of the project is estimated to be $7,151,000. Construction cost is estimated at $5.5 million, and there's high confidence in the construction cost estimate. Design was completed in December of 2020, and we expect to advertise for construction in February. Construction will take place later this fall during the in-water work period between October 21 and February 2022. Next slide. And that's all we have. So if there are any questions, we can take those now.
Colleagues, any questions at this point? I've got just a couple of basic questions that, you know, the pictures speak their thousand words. Obviously, we need to do the project. It looked like in the underwater survey that the outfall pipes themselves are creating sediment buildup. Is that unusual? Is that something that can be anticipated?
Generally, the sands have shifted, and we've had several bathymetric surveys taken, and we'll have one more this summer before construction actually starts. But what you end up seeing is with storms, there's scour events around the risers, so that contributes to the different depths and elevations. But also the flow coming out of those, sometimes they'll kind of flush the sand away from the diffuser port. But in general, that there's been sort of an increase in buildup over time.
Is there a suggestion here that these should be maintained more regularly in terms of dredging or doing whatever you need to do to keep those ports clear?
These have been in place going on 20, 22 years. I don't know if it's so much that, maybe there'll be some of that in the future, but, engineers took a pretty close look at it and tried to come up with an elevation for the new diffuser ports really to accommodate where they see that trend kind of going in the future.
How often are they inspected?
I can add to that. I think we're on a 5-year cycle with these bathymetric surveys. So that way we can see the idea is to catch if there's any accumulation before they start plugging the ports. So we do that. But these have been, as Phil was explaining, kind of buried in certain areas for quite a while now. And a key part is modifying those diffusers, get them up a little higher, and then monitoring. And then where we do need to go in and do some dredging, we can do that. We've also got an operational strategy. If you notice, we have two outfalls, outfall one and outfall three. And outfall three has typically been used intermittently. So now we're going to change that operational strategy to alternate them more often. So as they operate, they'll help kind of flush out any lighter accumulation of debris over the near the diffuser ports.
I guess my question is really this, is the strategy you are suggesting is go in and clean it out and build taller diffusers. My question is, rather than the capital investment, is there a maintenance strategy that's more efficient and potentially less costly?
Good question. We need to make the capital investments to get it up higher based on the surveys, but I think it's a combination of the two. Get this investment done and then have a more, feed forward type of maintenance strategy to address any future accumulations.
Okay, but just to ask the question rather directly, it's not a lack of maintenance that is leading to the buildup around the diffusers. It is a shift overall in the floor of the river that would have happened yes. whether or not the diffusers were there.
Is yes. that what you're saying? Yeah, exactly. Okay. We have theories because as Phil explained that these diffusers have been around for a while, but there were dams removed upstream that feed into the Columbia over the years. I think there was one on the Sandy River a while back that some of these dam removal projects may have brought slugs of sediment over time down. And we do have kind of a dead zone down here. So that's the idea is, we still need to make these improvements.
Okay, and then last question is, you showed a photograph of sediment on the bottom of the river, obviously pouring into one of the diffusers. And I assume the ones that are covered are also clogged. How do you unclog those? How do you get the, I presume the entire outfall pipe is full of sediment. How do you clean that out?
Yeah, that'll actually be diver assisted. So all of the work is going to be accessed on the Columbia River with barges. So they'll have diver teams that'll assist in just about every part of the work. Divers will actually enter into the outfalls through manways and do the clean out that way.
Wow. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. That's my questions. It looks like Commissioner Ryan, I think you had your hand up next then, Commissioner Hardesty, if I got that right.
Sure. Thank you, Mayor. And thank you, Commissioner Mapps, for bringing this to the dais. I enjoyed the presentation. I actually have a neighborhood question, and I'll tell you why. It's personal. I guess it's a day like that with the Dharma bums, reflecting on that earlier. And now I'm thinking about the late 70s when I lived with my parents, my mom mostly, when I went to high school, just off that lagoon, about 5 mobile homes in. And so I hung out in that area a lot. What's the neighborhood engagement been on this project? Have they been informed? I just remember even as a high school kid that we often felt very isolated out there in terms of, does the city care what we think? So I just wanted to know about that engagement process.
Yeah, there's been a lot of engagement with the advisory committee up at the plant. So there's been outreach that way and through the North Portland Business Alliance. Again, generally, since we're not accessing by land, all of the work is going to be by boat and barge. There's not a lot of public impact. primarily our concern is going to be, you know, making sure we're communicating with Coast Guard and through those groups. So primarily through the boater community more than on land.
Okay. And so will there be, I mean, is it a noisy operation that takes place? I realize you talked about diving and it's in the water. I heard all that.
We're not expecting a noisy operation. You know, there'll be some underwater shoring to install to get the excavations done so we can make the repairs. But no, we're not expecting a lot of noise.
Thank you.
Yep.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you for that very detailed presentation. My question may be a bit premature, and it's okay if it is, but I've actually calculated the four proposals that are being brought to us today from BES total over $41 million. And which is a huge investment, of course, that of public resources. Are you looking internally about how you leverage these $41 million in funds to ensure that we are contracting with communities of color and women contractors? And what's the strategy around making sure out of these four projects that at the end of the day, that we've actually significantly shifted the universe?
And I can speak to this project. We're obviously concerned about this particular project because of the specialty nature of the work. It's going to be, we're going to be pretty limited in the number of contractors and subcontractors that'll perform this type of work. So early on, I've tried to reach out and connect with procurement to talk about strategy. You know, what could we do to maybe get more public outreach? I talked internally with our procurement staff, with the procurement bureau, and then I also reached out to Port of Portland to try to get some idea of, you know, how do they handle these types of jobs? You know, they do a lot of marine type work with ports, diver work. So I spoke to them about, you know, the type of outreach they do. And admittedly, they said they struggle with these types of projects. I did search through the list of certified contractors to try to locate any contractors that might have experience, even, you know, at the subcontract level that could help us. Try to identify any work that we thought could be subcontracted. And so I reached out to a lot of those contractors to get contact information so that we can make sure that, you know, they're aware of the project when it does advertise. And then I reached out to a few organizations that have, you know, member contractors to let them know that, you know, this is going to be a project that's coming out. We'd like them to share it with member contractors that might be qualified to do some of the work. That was Latino Built, Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, Professional Business Development Group, and also the National Association of Minority Contractors. So I think the general strategy for us is to try to get as much outreach as we can to try to increase that level of participation. But beyond that, it is a low bid project. So it really does come down to getting them to participate and then submit qualified bids. Paul may be able to talk about the broader strategy around the four projects.
Yeah, and just add, that's kind of our, since these are all four low bid projects that we have on the agenda, I think Joe's got some more information on the next item as well to share. But our approach is to go ahead and increase the outreach, the to the organizations that Phil just mentioned for all four of these projects. We think we got a lot, tremendous amount of work opportunities to support the local contracting community. So really is we still have some time for some, especially the other projects, to get some more outreach out there.
Great, can you guys hear me? Yeah, so for the record, I'm Joe Dvorak with Bureau of Environmental Services. And item 60, we will be going into more detail, but I'll just add to what Phil and Paul were saying. Ours is the largest of that portion of work, Commissioner, as you can see. We plan to host a COBID outreach meeting with primes and potential subs where we get those folks together and they can ask specific questions about the Buckman East project and establish connections and partnerships during bidding, in addition to the different outreach that Phil talked about. I will just say for a strategy going forward, I think we all recognize that alternate delivery, the proposal-based solicitations, is a tool where we can increase diversity in contracting. That's something the Bureau will be looking at harder, certainly on our pipe projects. We went through that analysis for the Buckman project that Eric will talk to us about, and we couldn't produce the findings, unfortunately. But I'm confident that...
I did read that, but for me, it's like, so we have four major projects, right? We're going to do an RFP process. I'm really looking for innovation in the RFP that allows us to reach the goals that we want to reach, right? For decades, we've been hearing about, we just can't find people when we do the low bid, we just got to take, right? That's no longer going to be an acceptable solution to why we are not diversifying our contracting pool. So I'm hoping that as a bureau, that you're thinking, is it rewriting the contract in a way that gives you the results you want? Is it actually grading contractors to say, you didn't achieve our goal last time, you don't get the bid next time? I mean, I'm really looking for creativity, and I'm not, because I'm not going to be happy when you come back and say, we just couldn't find anybody, right? So I just want to put that on the record and encourage you to be creative. I know that there's something we could do different, and maybe it's how we write the contract. I don't know, but you guys are the experts in how you write your contracts. We must do things differently, and with $42 million going out the door in public funds, we could see that it's benefiting more than just the same operators. So I appreciate, and I know that you guys are thinking about this internally, but I wanted this to be on the public record that if we're spending this kind of public dollars, and we're not changing the outcomes, then we're not doing the job that we've been tasked with doing.
100%, Commissioner, I couldn't agree more.
Commissioner Hardesty, I agree, and I know with these projects, we've already kind of made that decision to go low bid, but to give you an example, one of the things we're currently working on in the spirit of innovation and contracting, you may recall a projects, and that was done in the prime contractor development program, but it was still a low bid, and we had limited success there. So that's the one we're now working on and getting partners involved and planning outreach with contractors where we plan to come to council in the next few months with a findings document to move to an alternative procurement where we do factor in, you know, DMW, ESB mentorship and other mm-hmm. factors mm-hmm. in the score that we're not just going low bid. So your message is heard is what I want to communicate. And we are trying to do things differently.
Thank you.
Very good. Any further questions at this particular time? Keelan, is there any public testimony on this item?
No one has signed up for this item.
All right, very good. Then this is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Thank you all. That was an interesting presentation. Next up, item 60.
Authorize a competitive solicitation and contract with the lowest responsible bidder and provide payment for construction of the Stark and Buckman East Reconstruction and Green Street Project number E10216 for an estimated cost of $23,837,000.
Commissioner Mapps.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Mayor, colleagues, I am really delighted to bring this project to your attention. This is one that really strikes close to home because it's going to happen in a neighborhood that I live in and love very much. This project will both protect the environment and improve the quality of life for those of us who live in inner Southeast Portland. Here's why we're here. Environmental Services is repairing and replacing more than 4 miles of sewer pipe and more than 150 manholes in inner Southeast Portland, specifically in the Buckman and Kearns neighborhoods. This project will protect public health, property, and the environment by replacing deteriorating pipes, which are more than 100 years old. This project will also add additional sewer capacity to meet current and future needs. And as part of this project, Environmental Services is going to be adding green infrastructure in the form of more than 71 green street planters that use plants and soil to absorb and filter stormwater. To tell us more about this important project today, we have Joe Dvorak, Division Manager, and Eric Brinicky. Project Manager, both with Environmental Services. And my apologies, Eric. We'll get it when you can tell us who you are on the record.
Great. So thank you, Commissioner, for that introduction. So again, Joe Dvorak with the Bureau of Environmental Services. Eric's prepared a brief presentation. So Keelan, would you mind bringing it up, please? Wonderful, thank you. And then I'll just turn it over to Eric at this point.
Great, thank you. My name is Eric Brenke. I'm the project manager for the Stark and Buckman Peace Reconstruction and Green Street project. Mayor and city councilors, what you have before you today is an ordinance to authorize a competitive solicitation and contract with the lowest responsible bidder and provide payment for the construction of this project for an estimated cost of $23.8 million. We are excited to present and highlight some of the benefits of this project today. Next slide, please. This project is part of the Neighborhood to the River into our program. Project goals are to implement and plan collection system projects that provide both watershed health and sewer system improvements through innovation, collaboration, and integration of our outreach efforts. Using this program delivery model makes sense in these neighborhoods. By working collaboratively, we develop and implement project solutions to deliver the greatest system to benefit our community and watershed areas. Program goals are best achieved through an integrated planning and implementation approach, which includes a combination of capital projects, such as this one, private property retrofit, vegetative improvements, education, community outreach, public involvement. Next slide, please. As far as the project location, the geographic location for this project is generally bounded by Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard to the south, Northeast Everett Street to the north, Northeast 32nd to the east, and Southeast 14th to the west. This area includes Colonel Summers Park and Lonesburg Cemetery. The project exhibits two neighborhoods represented in the purple: the Buckman neighborhood, located in the bottom left, and the Kearns neighborhood is located in the upper right. Next slide. Here's a closer look at the Buckman area. You can see where the green streets and denoted in the green locations in the purple there. We have numerous green street planters and curb extensions in the area, and we have pipe network in this neighborhood, which I'll explain a little bit further in the future slide. This area is generally bounded by Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard, Stark Street, Southeast 29th to the east, and Southeast 14th to the west. Next slide, please. This is the Kearns neighborhood, and it's just located above Lonesburg Cemetery. This area is bounded by Stark Street, Northeast Everett to the north, northeast 32nd to the east, and southeast 22nd to the west. We do have night work on this section, this neighborhood on Burnside. You can see that in the proposed for the red circles on Burnside. They're at four locations on Burnside Street, at Southeast 26th, Northeast 24th Avenue, Northeast 28th, and Northeast 32nd Avenue. We anticipate about 2 weeks of this night work. DES and PBI have coordinated early in the project to minimize potential night work and minimizing impacts to the neighborhood. Next slide, please. This project will result in the construction improvements that will replace pipes that are in poor structural condition and relieve street flooding and basement sewer backup. In all, we have about 11,400 linear feet of combined sewer pipe replacement due to insufficient capacity using open cut methods of construction. We have about 8,600 linear feet of new sanitary sewer pipe, just under 3,000 linear feet of sewer pipe put in place rehabilitation. And we're including 71 dedicated in-street facilities that is able to treat about just under 13,000, just over 15,000 square feet of stormwater area. We are proposing 106 curb ramps, all to update, get up to update it to ADA requirements. We are also addressing 50 blocks of non-conforming sewers in both neighborhoods. So that's a huge piece in this project. And as mentioned earlier, we have concrete structures, including over 150 manholes, 240 inlets to capture if this went off. Next slide, please. I believe we have with us is Debbie Castleton, and she's been doing a public involvement, been doing a great job. We have performed several mailings around in these neighborhoods throughout the design life of this project, informing the surrounding community of updated project information. We've had neighborhood public meetings, including those from the neighborhood association, to provide education and interaction about the project. And we've continued ongoing close coordination with residents and businesses regarding specific concerns and impacts, and accepted their feedback to help inform the design of the project all the way through. Next slide, please. The construction estimate is $23.8 million. We plan to begin construction May of this year, and November 2022, we're expected the end of construction. Next slide, please. That would be the end of the presentation, but we're happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Very good. Colleagues, any questions at this particular juncture? I do not see any. Keelan, is there any public questions? Yep, Commissioner Hardesty, go for it.
Low. What is the percentage you would say of failing pipes in the city of Portland?
Now that's a failing pipes. Well, what we're doing is identifying pipes that are almost 100 years old, and a lot of these pipes, we're replacing some of the combined sewers. But we're also identifying through TV, TV and some of the lines, we'll notice some cracks. We're trying to do some CIPP lining within those systems as well. But we usually get warnings of failing pipes, and we try to address them and try to address the risk in our modeling.
So can you tell me what percentage is pipes that are over 100 years old in the city of Portland?
Yeah, I can tell you that, Commissioner. Over one third.
Over a third. Thank you. And is there a geographic area that is more prone to pipes disintegrating or being worse than other areas of the city?
Yeah, I can start with that, and Eric, you can tune me up if needed. So generally, the neighborhoods inner, closer to the downtown core, those were built earlier, so that's where the oldest sewers are. They're clay, they're made of terracotta clay, so those are more prone to failure. There are other parts, not quite as far east, where we have brand new plastic sewers, but sort of in the middle ground, which are concrete, and concrete deteriorates at a different rate. So I'd say it's kind of widespread between, say, the river and 82nd, more so within the core.
Thank you. That's really helpful. Just imagining pipes, and as you say, right, we're making pipes from different material today than we did 100 years ago. And there's different wear and tear just based on what material was utilized. So I'm just fascinated by this. Like, the mayor geeked out on the last one. I'm geeking out on this one because I still remember the North Portland pipe failure that we had a couple of years back, and just how disruptive that was to the families that lived in that community. So what I'm assuming is that you're prioritizing areas that you think has the most potential for pipe failures. Would I be accurate with that?
Correct. And failure being structural failure, but then also we consider a failure if the pipes don't have capacity. A failure is getting sewage out on the street or in people's homes and businesses. So both structural and capacity.
Thank you. That was helpful.
Very good. Colleagues, any other questions? Keelan, do we have public testimony on this item?
No one signed up for this item.
All right, very good. This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Great presentation. Thank you. 61, please.
Authorize a competitive solicitation and contract with the lowest responsible bidder and provide payment for construction of the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant Headworks Screening Improvements Project number E10805 for an estimated amount of $12 million.
Commissioner Mapps.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor, colleagues. Again, I have another important environmental service project to bring to your attention. Environmental Services operates the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant. That's the largest treatment plant in the entire state. We serve more than 600,000 people every hour of every day. Now, the entry to the treatment process is the headworks, where screens trap and remove debris that travels through the sewers and the stormwater pipes. These screens were installed in 1994 and have outlived their useful life. This replacement project will improve both debris removal, and frankly, this is something that we need to do as a city in order to comply with the plant's permit. To tell us more about this important project, we have Chris Selker, project manager, and Paul Suto, engineer manager, both with Environmental Services. Chris, Paul, please take the floor.
Thank you, Commissioner Mapps. Once again, good morning, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. I'm Paul Suto, engineering manager with BES. So one thing I just want to point out here, this, the kind of a cool thing here at this council session is we have two projects. One we just heard about, the outfall project, is our treated effluent. Now we get to hear about a project of the raw sewage that comes in and gets treated. So it's a, as Commissioner Mapps said, it's a facility that's in need of some rehab to provide better service and treatment. And I'll turn it over to Chris Selker for the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. I'm going to go ahead and share my screen, hoping this works. Screen one, there. And, okay. I can't see myself, but let me see if I can do this where I can see myself.
We don't have your graphic. Nope.
You do. You cannot see my screen?
Nope.
No, we cannot.
Okay, I'm gonna try this again. Escape. Share my screen. There. Can you see it now?
Not yet.
No. Were you added as a host?
I think so. Okay, how about now?
No.
Nope.
Let's see.
Keelan, is she currently added as a host?
Yes, Chris. Yeah, Chris should be able to share her screen. But Chris, if you want, we can bring it up for you as well.
Yeah, maybe
Keelan yeah.
do that, and then she can.
Yeah, let's just do that. And let me escape. Let's see. Okay, great. Thank you, Keelan. Thank you, Paul and Commissioner Max, and good morning, Mayor Wheeler and members of council. I'm Chris Selker, and I'm an engineer at the Bureau of Environmental Services and project manager for the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant Headwork Screening Improvements Project. And I'm here today to request council approval of an ordinance to authorize competitive solicitation and a contract for construction of the project. Today I'll present project requirements, objectives, overview, budget, and schedule. Next slide, please. So as Paul pointed out this morning, you've seen a project on the collection system from Eric and on the outfall system from Phil. This project is physically between the two. It's within the Columbia Boulevard plant itself. As Phil said, the plant is located in North Portland. The first building that the wastewater comes into is called the Headworks, and the first treatment unit within the Headworks is the bar screens. The bar screens remove debris from the wastewater flow, for example, leaves, rags, and plastics. The photo on the left shows the existing 5 bar screens located in the Headworks building. The bar screens were installed when the Headworks was built in 1994, as Commissioner Mapp said, which is 27 years ago, and they've outlived their useful life. The right-hand photo shows the vertical bars in the bar screens catching debris. A rake arm comes down the face of the screen periodically and cleans it off. In this photo, however, the screen has been overwhelmed and has plugged with screenings. When a screen gets plugged like this, flow and debris go around the screen and the debris doesn't get removed from the flow. Since 2012, when the CSO program was completed, less stormwater and debris have been getting into the river, but as a result, more stormwater and debris have been reaching the plant. The existing screens are not effective enough at removing debris, so are not currently meeting their expected level of service. Next slide, please. The primary objective of the project is to meet the level of service of the bar screens, which is to treat peak flows of 300 million gallons per day without plugging. Meeting that objective will reduce the amount of debris reaching downstream pipes, equipment, and tanks, and that will reduce plugging and allow downstream units to function at their full capacity. Meeting this objective will also reduce the amount of debris, for example, plastics, that reach the waterway. In addition, other project objectives are to improve screening, washing, and compacting. The photo on the left is a non-functional washer compactor, which will be replaced. Another objective is to increase safe access to downstream piping. The photo on the right is existing downstream piping with temporary access platform, which will be replaced with a safer permanent platform. A third objective is to improve reliability of related Headworks equipment. Next slide. The project scope is to replace the bar screens and associated equipment and to modify downstream piping for less plugging and adding a permanent platform for safe access and other modifications to improve reliability of related Headworks equipment. The new bar screens will look like the drawing on the left. The new screens will have a higher capacity than the existing screens. They will be a multi-rake type. The rakes will be attached to a chain, which is colored yellow in this drawing. The rakes will continually rake the screen face to reduce plugging. The screens will have narrower openings between the vertical bars to catch more debris. The screens currently have 5/8-inch openings, but the new screens will have 1/4-inch openings. The new screening washers will look like the photo on the right. The large tank is the washer. The screenings will be compacted in the large tubes on the right. Next slide, please. These drawings show the arrangement of the new equipment in the headworks. The left is the arrangement of the new screens, conveyor, and access platform. The screens are dark green, the conveyor is light green, and the access platform is blue. The screenings will drop from the back of the screens onto the conveyor. The drawing on the right is the arrangement of the new washer compactors. Screenings will drop from the floor above through the blue chute into the blue tanks. Those are the washer tanks. And then after washing, the screens will be compacted in the light green tubes and dumped into the dumpsters on the right. They won't really be these colors, but that's just how they're shown now. Next slide, please. Regarding project budget, the total project cost is estimated to be $20 million. The construction cost estimate is estimated at $12 million. There's a high level of confidence in the construction cost estimate. Regarding project schedule, the design is expected to be completed in spring. We expect to advertise the construction contract in late spring, early summer. Construction is expected to take place from winter 2021 to winter 2024. And we're limited when we can get into these screen channels just to the dry season. Next slide. That's all I have. Does anybody have questions?
Colleagues, any questions at this point?
Yeah, just a comment. Chris, first of all, thank you for being patient and hanging in there and getting your screen up. I just want to say I was ready to ask, why is this construction going to take so long? And then you reminded us that it can only be in the dry season. So thank you for telling us that.
Sure.
Great presentation.
Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to say I appreciate you laying out the goals around how you're going to ensure that minority and women-owned contractors are going to be utilized. I see that you're going to use the city subcontractor equity program, and that monthly you're going to be making sure that the primary contractors are meeting their goals around subcontracting. So I just want you to know I appreciate that. I talk collectively about all these projects, but clearly this project has thought about how they're going to make sure that they make opportunity available. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any, is anybody signed up for public testimony, Keelan?
I signed up for this item.
I'm sorry, nobody has?
Right, that's correct. No one has signed up for this.
Very item. Good. This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. Thank you. Last item, item 6.2.
Authorize a competitive solicitation and contract with the lowest responsive and responsible bidder and provide payment for construction of the Ankeny Pump Station Odor Treatment System Rehab Project number E11093 for an estimated amount of $1,200,000.
Commissioner Mapps.
Yes, Mr. Mayor, colleagues, I'm delighted to bring this project to your attention. It's important, and I think once you understand what we're doing here, you will see and experience the city in a different way. As some of you know, Environmental Services manages 99 pump stations that send wastewater through the city pipes to the Columbia Boulevard Wastewater Treatment Plant. Now, We're here today to talk about the Ankeny Pump Station and Odor Treatment System, which is located right underneath the Burnside Bridge on the waterfront. You all know it from the Saturday Market. You probably have noticed that industrial looking building right on the waterfront and have wondered what it is. That's what it is. It's an odor treatment system and a pump station. The odor treatment system has been out of service since 2015 when a flood event caused some pipes to break. This is a problem because when the odor treatment system does not work, that whole area would smell like rotten eggs. We'd like to get this facility back up online. This project would rehabilitate the odor treatment system and bring the whole pump station back in service. I'm glad that we have Hong Nguyen, a senior engineering associate, and Paul Suto, engineering manager with environmental services, to tell us more about this important project. Hong, Paul, tell us about this one.
Thank you again, Commissioner Mapps. And again, I'm Paul Suto, engineering manager with BES. One other thing I just want to point out, I think Ankeny Pump Station is kind of a historic pump station for us. It's the city's first sewage pump station, and it's also one of our largest. So it's a critical one. It keeps downtown Portland essentially from flooding. So just kind of connecting that with the critical need to keep that system reliable, and now to kind of minimize the odor impacts to the local community. So I'll turn over to Hoon to give you the overview of the project. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. So I'm gonna attempt to share the screen again. And if I cannot do that, so I will ask Keelan to do so. So let me share. Can you see my screen?
Yes.
Looks awesome. So I am Hoon Nguyen. I'm a senior engineering associate and project manager for this project as well. I'm gonna dive right into the project where I will show you the locations of the project, the reason why we need the odor treatment system, the existing installations. We'll talk about the project objective, and then we'll touch on the budget and schedule. So it's appeared that I have a difficulty advancing. So not sure why.
Keelan, is there any reason why it wouldn't work? Can you think of genius solutions?
Would it be easier, Hyung, if we?
Yeah. Okay. I think I have to bring up this screen. So yes. So you can see the map for the locations. The odor treatment facility is located just north of the bridge. This is a bridge. You see my cursor too, right? So this is the odor treatment facility just north of the bridge. It consists of a media vault and an equipment vault. Both of this facility are underground. So there's a fence in the equipment vault will draw air from the Ankeny pump stations and Ankeny shaft located south of the bridge. The both Ankeny pump stations and Ankeny shaft is currently in service. Just the odor treatment facility is out of service. And so I am bringing it up, a closer up photos of the odor treatment facility. These are the hatch to access the underground facility. You see the stack on the left, on the photo on the left, that is the stack where the treated air is vented through the atmosphere. And why we need odor treatment? So odor from sewage system is very offensive to human, and we can detect it at very low concentrations of certain compounds. So when we convey the sewage from the collection system to the treatment plant, there are so many manhole and inlet that connected to the system, and the odor, odorous air can escape it through that manhole or inlet. The second reason for this project is the odor treatment facility is also provide ventilations for the Ankeny pump station wet well and the Ankeny access room. So the wet well is where the sewage come in into the pump stations. And the photo, the big photo here is Ankeny pump station wet well access room. Below that is the wet well. So this photo was taken when the odor treatment was out of service. As you can see, there was a lot of condensations and that promote mold growth and it's also corroded our equipment.
So I think that qualifies as the new worst workspace in the city of Portland.
You could say, yes, it was basically it was dripping with water, just like rain. So when the staff coming into this area, they probably, they need to wear raincoat, basically. And I did, okay. Yeah.
point well taken.
yes, so it was.
Commissioner Mapp, you're in charge. Keep the OSHA people out till we get this fixed.
Yes, so as I mentioned earlier too, the locations and of the pump stations is right at the Burnside Bridge area where the Saturday market occur. So there's a lot of public, biker and the pedestrian. So treating the odor here is to, we try to improve the benefit for the public, basically, create a healthy environment and also make a good neighbor. Here is the existing photo of the existing conditions of the odor treatment facility. The one on the left was taken in 2015, where it's just out of service. You can see the coating is still intact. But in 2019, it's continued to deteriorate. And you can see the coating start to peel off. So we would like to, start the constructions and rehab this project as soon as we can. Underneath the hatch, this is the existing installation. Basically, the foul air is follow the red arrow to the media vault, where this is where the odor treatment is treated, and it will be discharged out to this stack. So this media is an engineering media where the bacteria is coated into the rock type, and then the bacteria will basically consume the odorous compound, and then discharge clean air coming out. This technology is a little bit more, require more maintenance, and because it needs water to water the media and keep the moisture to promote bacteria to grow. In 2015, this the water line that coming to the system and it broke, and it's literally a flood the system about kind of 4 feet of the water in the vault and it's damage of the equipment. So with that, we are going to rehab the system with the objective that we will meet the current code and regulations. We will build a reliable system that is easy to maintain and operate. And most important, we have to eliminate the offensive odors. So you can see in the layout, the foul air is follow the red line, go to the vessel. This is the vessel where we will treat the odor and then discharge out to the environment. This is an isometric of the new odor treatment system where the foul air is follow the red line arrowed and get it out. Inside this box, the rectangular box. There will be carbon, activate carbon. It's a to remove the odor, and there's another polishing media after that. And it will, this layer of media will be stored inside this vessel. So we are currently finishing the design and plan it to bid in March. And then the construction's notice to proceed in July of 2021 and complete in 2022. The current project, the budget is $2 million, and we have about 1.4 million to spend during constructions and startup and close out. And that is all I have for the presentation. Is there any question?
Oh, I'm sure there are. Anybody want to go first, or should I?
Ma'am, I'd like to go first. Oh. You could go first if you'd like.
All right, well, I'll just ask the same question I asked previously. These are unacceptable workspaces. I'm sitting here looking at photos in the presentation of water pouring out of electrical light sockets. God knows what that is growing all over the place. And we're sending our employees into these facilities. How did it get to this point?
So the maintenance for the facility that we normally have is staff coming in every 6 months. And you know, maintain the facility. It was not a safe environment. So in 2015, we took immediate project to address that issues. But we basically isolate that wet well, and we remove all of the mold and the coating. We repaint it, recoat it.
Oh, so employees were not going into it in that condition. Is that accurate?
Yes. Yes, we don't want to have the employee come into that condition.
Because I would hope as a minimum standard that we would not willfully send our employees into a workspace that looks like that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And I appreciate the presentation. You made a crystal clear and very compelling case. Thank you. Commissioner Hardesty.
Thank you, Mayor. And that was one of my questions. I appreciate you asking that question. I was horrified as well. Commissioner Mapp said that we have 99 pump stations. What is the condition of the other 98 pump stations? And what's the proactive way that we could make sure that the deterioration that we're seeing in this Ankeny station is not repeated throughout our system?
Yeah, so Paul, you want to go first?
Sure, I can. You can add to it, Hoon. But I'll say, the condition varies. Obviously, we have 99, and they've been built over a wide period of time. Essentially, we do have a condition assessment program that's been ramping up. That's looking at the various conditions, so we can be more proactive in addressing situations and preventing these. This is an extreme example. With this odor control system that we had tied to the system and this failure. So I'd say this, we don't have any like this. Most of our issues are around just pumps and electrical equipment wearing out and getting beyond their useful life. So it's more of a reliability risk we have in terms of failure, and that could lead to sewage overflows.
Yes, and I would like to add on a little bit more. Normally, the 99 pump station that you would see is we have the odor treatment within the pump stations. Ankeny is different. It's located right where that historical area, and so it's very difficult to modify or put in anything in that historical area. And so that's the reason why we have to select the odor treatment facility that is underground. So it's a little bit farther, and that's very rare for us to have those circumstances. And also I have to say that our staff is working in very difficult environment. Entering the wet well is a confined space entry. So this room, we would consider something, you know, if they have to enter it, it is confined space entry.
Excellent. I really appreciate those responses. And your presentation was fabulous. And it really actually reflected the work that needs to take place. So I thank you both for that presentation.
I think you are muted.
Thanks, Hunk. Commissioner Mapps has a question.
More of a statement. I know we're wrapping up. I just wanted to thank everyone who presented today, Philip, Paul, Joe, Eric, Chris, Hoon, for excellent presentations. And I know there are a bunch of people in the back office who made it possible for these projects to come to the point where they are, and for these presentations to get before us today. Just really excellent work, Environmental Services. We're proud of you, and we look forward to seeing these on second reading.
Very good. And there is no public testimony. Is that correct, Keelan?
Actually, we do have one person signed up.
Very good. Welcome.
We have Candace Starks.
Hi, Candace.
Hi. It's just my first community meeting. And when I signed up online, they kind of made me select an option to speak about. So I don't really have anything to say. I was just listening.
Oh, okay. No worries. We appreciate your listening in. Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet.
Angus.
All right. This is a first reading of a non-emergency ordinance. It moves to second reading. And colleagues, with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.